You're listening to a podcast from 702.
702.
The Naked Scientist.
We connect with Dr. Chris Smith this afternoon, and we're taking your calls for your science-related questions. Hello, Chris.
Hello.
You in the corridors of a hospital this afternoon?
Well, not quite that bad, but in my office. But,
in your office.
Yeah, another busy day.
Okay, hopefully you won't get called away to something or other in this half hour. But we'll understand. We'll understand if that happens. That should take precedence. So let's go to the lines. There are a couple of questions already lined up for you, Chris. Some coming in on our WhatsApp line, 0727021702. And for the rest, you can give us a call now on 011-883-0702. Anne, you're in Bryanston. Hello. Afternoon, Anne.
Hello. Sorry, the phone line is a bit indistinct. I wanted to know how radio stations and TV stations ascertain how many listeners they have to a particular program, mm-hmm. and whether it's just 30 seconds as somebody surfs the TV, or what happens.
Right.
Hi, Anne. You know, this used to be a perennial problem. Advertisers need to know these sorts of numbers, and also regulators like to know these sorts of numbers so they can assess and appraise the impact of a program and then the value of potential advertising or the reach of a program. Now, in the good old days, the way that you would do this sounds horrendous statistically, but and it's still done to an extent. You give people diaries, and you have a group of people who are regarded as representative of the audience for all radio or all television, and you ask them to write down what they listened to or watched and when.
Yeah.
Yes, it really is as primitive as that. Now, it has moved on a bit in the sense that nowadays people have got various other devices, podcasting, for example, or electronic distribution, streaming services, pay-per-view type services. Obviously, you can tell exactly what people have listened to, where they've listened to it or watched it, and how much of it they consumed. And this is giving far finer-grained information to potential advertisers, to people who are trying to develop compelling programs that we all want to watch and listen to. And in some cases, it's even gone a step further, where smart TVs have cameras built into them, and they actually can tell or listen to, because of microphones there as well, what people are doing and what they're watching and when they're actually engaged with the TV program. So it really is Big Brother stuff these days, but thankfully, at the moment, that's fairly limited. So the answer is, old days, it was literally primitive diaries. This modern era, still doing diaries in some cases, but equally moving towards new ways of doing this digitally by using data on consumption, because most people are accessing programs over smart devices that can actually return information about listener habits to the broadcaster or to the distributor.
I think the digital one is far more accurate, because with people writing things down in diaries, there's that recency bias, and of course when you know that you are participating, behavior can also be altered or changed as a result. So next, let's go to, that was Anne. We've got Joe in Killarney. Hello, Joe.
Hello, Azania. Lovely show you have.
Thank you.
I want
welcome.
To ask Dr. Smith two questions related to the coronavirus.
Mm-hmm.
Firstly, with regard to symptomatic patients, we know that they transmit the infection by droplets and by fomites. But in asymptomatic patients, how do they actually transmit the infection? And secondly, how long is the virus excreted from the body? 4 weeks?
Hi, Joe.
Longer?
Okay.
Yeah, we are learning this all the time. When we first began down this pathway, we weren't even aware that there were a significant number of people who have the infection and they're asymptomatic. That obviously has been a very big learning point. Maybe as many as two-thirds of cases have no or have very trivial symptoms, and as a result may dismiss those symptoms or regard themselves as of no risk. As far as we can tell, those individuals are going to pass on the virus, if they are, in exactly the same way as the next person. And that includes droplets from the respiratory tract. And, you know, everyone coughs or breathes heavily. Just the act of breathing, talking, speaking, shouting. If you run upstairs and breathe a bit more heavily, you will blow out more respiratory droplets from your airways. And if there's virus growing in your airways, it comes prepackaged in those droplets and then goes out into the air. Regardless of whether or not you have symptoms, you will potentially shed virus that way. The other way that it might be spreading is that it goes down the toilet, because you also have cells lining your digestive tract that have the marker on them that the virus needs to get it into cells. So we think at least a proportion of the infection can occur via the GI tract, the intestine, and therefore what comes out of your body downwards as well as upwards could potentially be infectious. And the evidence for this is that people have been able to detect the genetic code of the virus at the sewage works, suggesting that it is going down the toilet. Now, whether it's infectious still by that time, we don't know, because just because you can detect the genetic signature of something does not mean it's infectious still, but there's a theoretical risk of that. And so therefore, when people go to the loo, flush the loo and create that plume of material that comes out of the toilet when you flush it, yes, unfortunately, that is the case. And most people put their toothbrush right next door to the toilet. What a pleasant thought. But that could also be one route of transmission as well. Again, if you're asymptomatic, you still will have virus leaving your body, but potentially in smaller amounts than someone who's symptomatic. So therefore, the overall amount of virus you may be shedding may be smaller, but it's still capable of infecting a susceptible individual.
Hmm. Joe, thank you for your questions. And then we have Deanne in Midrand. Deanne?
Hello there. Good afternoon, Zania, and hello, Naked Scientists. My question is, I've been reading a book about our solar system, about the planets, and also our stars, which is the sun. And every one of them, there is a drawing of the planet. Some have got photographs, but they all draw down to the core of that planet, to Neptune, Mars, Venus, Pluto. Well, Pluto is not a planet, but all of them. And they tell us then what that is core is made of. How do they know what that's made of?
Yeah, what a brilliant question. The answer to this is that we know how much these planets weigh, in inverted commas. And what I'm actually referring to is the concept of mass. The planets are made of stuff, and stuff is made of atoms, and atoms are all individually different and have mass. So if you put lots of them together, they have mass. And if you want to, you could weigh the Earth. The Earth weighs about 6 times 10 to the 24 kilograms. So in other words, 6 with 24 noughts after it, kilos, is the mass of our Earth. And you can do this because you can work out the size of the planet, you know where it is in relation to the sun, you know how fast it's moving, and you can therefore work out its gravitational influence. And you can then work out, based on its size and how much it weighs, in inverted commas, its density, and if you know the density, you can have an approximation of what it must be made of. And so we know that the inner planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, they're rocky planets, and I mean part of that's obvious, we live on one of them. And then beyond that, when you're into the Jupiter, Neptune, Uranus zone, those are gas giants, they're gassy planets. They've probably got a small rocky core, but most of it's gas, like hydrogen. But you can work that out based on how big they are, how fast they're moving, their density, and then work out what their composition is. And if you know what the composition is, you can work out basically what's in there. And because heavy things settle towards the middle and lighter things rise towards the top, you can approximate what each of the different zones inside those planets is likely to be made of.
Right. And I mean, just what was it, last week or so, there were these possible markers about potentially there have been life on Venus.
Yeah, that's right. So a group of researchers internationally were using telescopes to look at the clouds around Venus. And what they saw was a light signal corresponding to the presence of the molecule phosphine. Mm. Phosphine looks like a little molecular pyramid. It's a phosphorus atom with three legs like a tripod, which are hydrogen atoms. And we get this on Earth, and on Earth it is made by life processes. There are microorganisms that have the biochemistry that enables them to churn this stuff out. We've also found it in other planets in the solar system, including around gas giants like Jupiter. And there's various chemistries that can make it possible. But those chemistries wouldn't exist on Venus. Mm. And so to find it in the clouds high up in the atmosphere around Venus asks the question, well, where did it come from then? Because we're not aware of any chemistry that's going on in that sector of Venus that would cause this. But this gives you the tantalizing hypothesis, well, is there life on Venus? Now, it would have to be a pretty extreme form of life, because although Venus is very similar to the Earth in terms of its size and its therefore gravity and so on, and its proximity to the sun. Mm-hmm. Venus has a runaway greenhouse effect. The pressures on the surface of Venus are crushing. It's like 450 times the pressure on the surface of the Earth. And the temperature on the surface of Venus is hot enough to melt lead. It rains sulfuric acid on Venus. It's not a nice place. So if life existed there, it's pretty hardy life. But at the same time, high up in the clouds around Venus, the conditions are likely to be a bit milder. And under those circumstances, it might be possible for some kind of life process to be existing up there in those warm but not searingly hot sulfuric acid clouds. And so it may be that there is some life process there that's giving rise to this phosphine signature. On the other hand, it could be some chemistry that we haven't discovered or accounted for yet. And so scientists need to investigate this more thoroughly in order to, A, confirm it, and B, try to work out where it's coming from.
Fascinating. Here's a question from Gugu in Lysonia. She has texted us to say, so, I have a decaying tooth and it has a hole. I like eating my sandwich with uncooked tomato, and a tomato seed got into my tooth. I don't remember when now, but today I was poking my tooth and the seed came out and it looked like it was about to germinate. Is it possible that it was going to shoot from in there?
Well, it's possible. I mean, they do say the best tomato plants grow at the sewage works. And seeds are very robust little capsules that are designed to pass through animals and get out the other end and germinate where you plant them in a pre-made pile of fertilizer. So, in other words, seeds don't need light. They need warmth and dampness as the triggers to start the germination process. And so it is entirely plausible if the seed wasn't cracked open by eating it, which, you know, it's pretty hard to crunch up these seeds, and they're coated in a jelly-like lubricant that means they tend to slip around in your mouth and don't get crushed in your teeth, so they do just get swallowed. It's perfectly possible that it did begin to germinate lodged in that place. So, yes, I think that is plausible. It's warm, it's wet, it doesn't care about light, and there will be some bacteria there, there will be some acid there, but then the soil is a bit acidic under certain circumstances, so that wouldn't be a deterrent to the seed.
Yes.
And in fact, I did publish an article on The Naked Scientist a few years back by an Indian doctor who sent me this case report of a gentleman who came in to see him in the accident and emergency department and had an earache. And this guy said, I've had this terrible earache for a number of weeks. It's getting worse and worse and worse. And when the doctor looked in the ear, they found there was a wheat seed growing in there. There's actually a wheat plant growing in this guy's ear. And what has happened is he was harvested. He's involved in the harvest.
Yeah.
And the plant had seed. It obviously got into his ear when he was shaking the wheat he was harvesting.
Mm.
And it settled in the earwax. And it was a nice, warm, damp environment, and it started to germinate, and it had grown all nice roots and things in his ear and was beginning to form a shoot that would have actually begun to protrude
out of his
external ear canal. And they hooked it out, and he said he felt much better after that. But the first sign was trouble was that it was giving him an earache.
Yes, yes. Oh, that's so fascinating. Gugu, thank you so much for taking us down this particular rabbit hole. Here are a few more questions. there are a few other questions, Chris. Lydia says, if you give the dog chili food, does it feel the hotness like we do? Lydia.
Yes, Lydia. Dogs do actually have sensitivity to chili. The spicy ingredient in chili is a molecule called capsaicin, and this molecule binds onto a particular target on the surface of nerve fibers in your nose and mouth. They're called TRPV1 receptors, and they normally signal heat. So when the chili molecule is present, it jams open a pore on the surface of that nerve cell, activating it quite powerfully. So basically, it fools your mouth into thinking it's a lot hotter than it really is. And mammals like us and dogs and cats and mice and rats have that receptor, so they can all taste chili. The individuals that can't taste chili are members of the bird family. They lack that receptor. So birds can eat chilies with impunity. They won't taste a hot burning sensation, but a mammal, including your pet dog, definitely will. And I've actually done the experiment myself, not intentionally, but when we've had curry, if you have leftover curry on the plate and you say to the dog, would you like this? And the dog, we've got a Labrador, they never say no to anything. You can't fill one of those up. And when you give it the plate of food, if it's quite a spicy curry, it starts off really enthusiastically, and then quite quickly its mouth obviously begins to feel like it's getting a bit of a burn, and it just stops eating. It's quite funny because you know it can't work out why. Nothing's changed, but it suddenly tastes different. Yeah. And then it goes away for a while, and then it comes back and thinks, "Oh, food," and starts eating again. And then it starts again. And it's because of the burn sensation coming up, and it fools your nervous system into thinking the temperature is much hotter in your mouth than it is, which is why chili tastes like your mouth is on fire. And we use words like burn, hot, and fire to describe the chili flavor, because it's activating the very same part of the nervous system without doing any harm, actually, that you would normally have activated were you really experiencing a high temperature.
And here's another one coming in on our WhatsApp line, because we're trying not to neglect these as well. But your calls as well on 011-883-0702. So on 072-702-1702, one says, please ask the naked scientist if one can block off things to the brain. I find that when someone is talking to me in a loud shouting voice, I tend not to hear what they are saying.
Well, the thing about attention is you can think of your attention as a bit like the spotlight illuminating the lead singer on a stage. You're aware that the stage is there and that things are going on, but you focus your attention on one bit of it, where the spotlight's shining. And our attention's very similar. So when you walk down the street, there's all this sensory information coming to you, from the feeling of your clothes on your back, your shoes on your feet, to the cars rushing past. But what are you focusing on? Probably the person you're having a conversation with on your smartphone, or you're just about to cross the road, is there a car coming? All these other events are happening to you, but your sensory systems are zoning out the things that it regards as not important for you to focus on at that moment in time. It's the same when you're talking to somebody. Some people, if they are talking to you in a certain way, or they're getting very boring and dull, never going to happen on your program, Zania, but you know, certain people drone on, or they have something very specific that they're doing that actually distracts you away from the content of what they're saying. You can have all this stuff going past and you completely miss the content, but you obsess about the thing that you focus on. So yes, you can definitely sort of move your attentional spotlight from one thing to another, and certainly if people distract you in a certain way, then this can mean you don't pay attention, and a lot of burglaries get committed that way. People become very good at working out this psychology, and they distract people in such a way that then their attention shifts and then they're becoming a victim of crime.
That's so fascinating. Let's take a listen to this voice note as well.
Hi, Azani, I'm Saka. It's time from Alberton. My question for the naked scientist today, I just want to ask, how did the lie detector machine sense that I'm lying? What if I speak with confidence? Does it still sense that I'm lying or not? Thanks, Gaza.
Right. How do you fool it? How does it know whether you're lying or telling the truth, a lie detector machine?
Right. Well, these systems use the conductivity of your skin, and it's basically exploiting the fact that when you are nervous, you sweat more. And this is because sweating is under the control of the part of the nervous system called the sympathetic nervous system. And when you are nervous, you activate your sympathetic nervous system, so you also sweat secondarily. And that's a sort of protective thing, because if you had to run away very fast or fight someone, you'd get very hot. So sweating would help to cool you down. So it's an anticipatory reflex of having to fly or fight. Now, when you tell lies, it makes you stressed. And if you become stressed, you activate your sympathetic nervous system, you sweat. Because sweat is salty, it's got sodium and other ions in it, the conductivity of sweat is higher than just normal water or dry skin. And so therefore, when a person is asked a whole bunch of questions, they initially will ask the normal questions just to see what their normal conductivity of their skin is. And then they start asking them hard questions. And if people suddenly get a big surge in the conductivity of their skin, it's because they've released a little burst of sweat. And this is associated with telling lies. And it's very, very non-specific, and it's relatively easy for people to fool it if they're very practiced.
Okay.
It's also for people who are just very nervous to fall for it and accidentally implicate themselves. So it's not admissible as a proper form of evidence in many courtrooms, but are very popular in films, especially in America.
Yes, yes. Chris, thank you. Thanks for joining us for our usual Mondays. So back to work it is for Chris Smith, the Naked Scientist, every Monday after 2:30. That's our time with him.